We humans are made of story, tell stories, and we essentially are stories, I suppose. And in listening to Larry this morning, I was reminded of something that, as a non-custodial parent, certainly touches my heart. We have been essentially sold, I guess maybe a way to say it, a bill of goods that there is a dominant story in which we all are to conform to. And that comes out of the Age of Enlightenment and the universal truths, when something like this, white men are superior, they think more, they think better. Mostly it's because I think they had the best natural resources to create the best weapons so they could dominate, so therefore they were considered better. But when we think back to the 50s, we think we were also sold another story through the media of television, that Donna Reed and June Cleaver and all those images, Ozzie and Harriet, the Brady Bunch, all those images portrayed the normal, healthy American family, and they were icons embedded in our mind, and that any stories other than these were stories to be feared and stories not to be told and stories that we would hide on the fringes of our culture. I can remember reading Larry Kent Graham's book about images of lovers when one man was dying of HIV/AIDS. How that story at first was demonized by our culture because it didn't fit the norm of the healthy family story. And personally, and I'm not sure Larry's story, but I know that the story of non-custodial parents has been demonized as deadbeat dads. But we don't hear the story of the broken heart as the father drives away from their child and might not see their child for months at a time. We don't hear that story. So anything that's not out of the conformity of the normal story, we don't hear. And yet we Unitarian Universalists, we need to be a place where all the stories are told. And I don't believe until all the stories are told and all the suffering of the stories is comforted that we cannot really understand peace and forgiveness. We need to be a place where all stories are welcomed. We need not be a place where we fear telling stories. We need not be a place where we fear to tell our stories. We need to be a house of welcoming, because indeed it is true that all of us have our own unique story and our own suffering. And if this is not a place where we can bring our hearts, then what is it? I was curious driving here this morning. I drive past this big church when I come up here, and I thought it was so odd that I saw law officers with guns to their belts walking all over the place at that church, and my first mind went, well, what's wrong? And then I knew that there was really nothing wrong. That's normal. That in the house of peace, that we have law officers carrying guns, and what's that about? And you may say, maybe I'm making too much of that. I don't know. Maybe I am, maybe I'm not. But it certainly did strike me that that was on the campus there. And again, that's another story. And as I was driving up here, Helen and I were talking, and this is the Sunday before the election, and so she says to me, well, make sure that we touch the hearts of people with peace and forgiveness. And I've got all these articles here of peace and elections and detention camps and habeas corpus stories and stories of shaming by the administration and Bush shaming other people and characterizing them as traitors, and knowing that we're going to have an election where there are people going to be elected that consider me a traitor to this country, and if they had their way would make laws which would lock me up, and I have some particular feelings about that. And so I'm $385 million for detention centers, and we don't know where they are, and I'm looking through all these looking through all these articles, things that I've been reading for this sermon, and then I come across this one. Otto Canoe and Company. Otto Canoe and Company is a company that creates canoes where you can pedal on the ground and go to the store and carry your stuff, but it also goes right into the water. So in the midst of all this craziness and all this and aggressiveness, there's this Otto Canoe article. Pushed in with all my, I don't know if you did that on purpose, how, but it sure struck me as funny when that happened. I said, is that like Pandora's box? All this craziness comes out and all of a sudden here's this Hope Quadricycle Incorporated, where you can ride bikes that have lids on it so you don't get rained on. You can go right up to the store and get your groceries and stuff like that. You know, and so all this is truth. That all these things are true, that we do have auto canoes, you know, in the middle of this. And I'm not sure they would arrest us for that at this point, not using oil, but they might. You never know. You never know where our society will get to. And I'm also aware that, so as you can, you know, I thought I would open up today with are you anxious? Remembering the last election with Kerry and how many of us in the congregation were very depressed after the election, wondering about our country, and so I thought, are we anxious, you know, about Tuesday and that anxiety? Where's my peace and where's my forgiveness? So, you know, I've got peace and forgiveness on one side, and I got all this anxiousness on the other, and I'm going, you know, if we don't vote, we might as well be slaves. And of course, maybe this isn't an election about ideology at all. Maybe this is an election to find out if the voting machines have a shred of honesty left at all. And so all this is just happening inside of me. And so I'm trying to fall between, you know, the inner world peace and what we need to be doing. And then it occurred to me, is it possible that, and as much as I started thinking about it this week, that I need to be engaged in conflict and activity in order to have peace within myself? Because at first I would think, oh no, that's not possible, we can't. But is it possible that when I do nothing, when I see something that is really egregious to my value system, and I do nothing, that I have no peace inside, and that the only way to have peace inside is to actually do something and engage in conflict? How do I draw a boundary between my private self and my public self? And we live in a culture that's erasing the boundary between private self and public self. We live in a culture where we're now beginning to see headlines that there's thought police. That you can go to a group that's dominated by Quakers and there will be an agent in the group to find out what you talk about, to evaluate your thoughts, to see if you come under the category of a combatant. And we live in that culture. So if I do nothing, am I at war within myself, but I'm at peace externally because I'm apathetic? Or how am I to bring some balance to that? How am I to understand the context in which I live in today? I got to read one of these things. Because I think this kind of... We must have a strong boundary between our private selves, what's going on within us, and the external world. And how can we tell when that boundary is weak? We can tell if I'm screaming at the television, at something somebody says. Guilty? Guilty, guilty, guilty. We have no place to be heard. We can tell when we go to a group and we know the group is going to be about good things, but and we talk about everybody, and say if it's about politics or about protesting, whatever, demonstrating, whatever it might be, and we haven't met before and we're in this group and we ask, you know, we go around the group and say, well, what would you like to get out of this group? And everybody has something really strong and powerful to say. It's like their pet passion that they want to say, and everybody says it, but they don't come back to the group anymore. It's like they never have we don't have a place where we can stay and we can say, this is where I'm going to stand, and no matter what happens, I'm going to be here every week and I'm going to show up every week, sometimes whether I like it or not, because this is a place I know I can be heard beyond my pet passion. And I may even have to put my pet passion on hold and help support somebody else's, which means I don't get center stage on that day. I must have a strong, sensitive, kind boundary that has some sense of justice between me and the external world, so that when I go to a meeting like that, it's just not about me expressing myself. I'm also available to hear what other people have to say, so that I can stay there week after week after week. Otherwise, I just come for one time and show up and say something, and I don't go there again, and I go back to isolation. Then I build up again, then I go to another meeting, I go back to isolation. It was Robert Winthrop who wrote about today's culture. He talks about groups, churches, support groups, and such. And he says one of the reasons why we don't have any depth in our culture, and why we don't have any depth in churches, and just because we go every week, that doesn't mean there's depth. The reason why we don't have any depth is because that if we get upset with one group, we get upset with one church, we can just go to another one. We can just go to another one. We become consumers of groups. So if I go to, say, one 12-step group and somebody actually gets confronted with me, and maybe I needed to be confronted particularly in that particular group, I don't go back anymore. I go to another one, but I'm still in recovery. So I go to a church and somebody says something either from the pulpit or afterward or somehow infringes upon my psyche. I don't want to go to that church anymore. Well, maybe my psyche needed a bit of infringing upon, and I'm not saying intrusive, I'm saying confrontation, awareness, insight. We must have a strong boundary between our private and our public self, because if we don't, this is what gets inside of me, and I have no way of organizing it. I don't know how many of you read the webpage Truth Out, www.truthout. If I don't have that boundary, this is what would seep inside of me, and believe me, drive me absolutely nuts. This is their front page. Haggard case fuels debate over hypocrisy. Bush names Exxon chief to chart Americans' energy. Israel's troops open fire on women outside mosque. No memory expert for Libby trial. Democrats predict voter ID problems at the polls. Senator George Allen's interrogated by police about a brawl. That's half of the first page. Then there's another page. Then there's another page. Then there's another page. Then there's another page. If I don't know how to protect myself, those stories will absolutely numb me and move me to a place to be apathetic, where I don't care. I must have a strong boundary to protect myself in this particular culture, or I have no chance to engage a sense of peace or spiritual discipline to move toward peace, and even have any hope at trying to understand forgiveness. Because in order for me to engage in a process of peace in my own inner world, and even to begin to understand what I have forgiven and what I have not forgiven, how many of us periodically will have a memory, and that memory will remind us that we have not forgiven? It may only creep up once every year, but it's still there, and it's still powerful, and it still has a twinge to it in our guts, and it still pulls energy from us. But we know that we have not forgiven. Much is being made of today. As a matter of fact, there's kind of a new industry coming out today about internal dialogue, what goes on in our inner world. How many of us know that we are not our inner world? We are not our internal dialogue. Do we know that? How many of us, when say we have a memory, or we do something we don't like, or somebody does something to us we don't like, and we begin to have this internal dialogue and say, I judge myself pretty harshly. Usually when I judge myself pretty harshly, there's a side of me feeling the harsh judgment. Usually shame is the response. So that side of me that's judging me harshly becomes dominant. That side of me that feels shame becomes very repressed. And often this is the best and most sensitive side of who we are, the side we repress, because this judge judges Many of us believe that is who we are. That's not who we are. We need to create an observer within ourselves. If we are going to move to the process of inner reconciliation and peace, we need to create an observer within ourselves to say to ourselves, hey, that's going on inside me. I'm having this argument. There's a side of myself judging another side of myself. If we get caught in the process of the inner dialogue and we believe that's all who we are, we will indeed be imprisoned for the rest of our lives. We need to have a process of inner reconciliation. And when we have that process of inner reconciliation, we begin to strengthen the boundary between our inner world and the external world. If I do not, I will internalize the dynamics from the external world, and that will be how I others, because they make no meaning. There's a numbness there. There's an evacuation of the meaning-making process. And what in the world is this statement, the evacuation of symbolism? How many of you have noticed this? About a year ago, I was talking to a public defender, prosecutor, and talking, he's a Democrat kind of guy, and I was talking to him. I said, we ought to get out in signs and march and do all this. He says, that has no meaning, and they all think you're crazy. And so I said, all right, I won't get out with signs and march and all that, right? But then I noticed there's a lot of signs out today, all over the place. I also noticed, I believe it was Karl Rove said, well, we don't know how this election is going to turn out because we've got $200 million we're going to spend on advertisement before the elections. What he's saying is we have $200 million to spend on signs. This has a direct relationship to this term symbolism. When you have a sign and the sign doesn't point to anything meaningful in the theological world, that's called death. Symbolisms, what symbols do is they point to something beyond themselves. They point to some truth, some meaning, some relationship beyond the symbol itself, so that we can use that process for dialogue and for understanding. And an alive symbol is always changing and always moving, and when a symbol no longer points to anything, it becomes a sign, and it's a dead symbol. What Karl Rove was pointing to, not just him as a Republican, but anybody who depends on advertisement to manipulate you to go vote for something that you don't know the outcome of your vote, is asking you to vote for death in theological terms. Asking you to vote for which you don't know the meaning of what you're voting for. You're voting for a sign. How in this culture that points us to death from a theological perspective, are we to move toward peace and forgiveness? Because peace and forgiveness are words that are symbols that point us to greater life. Greater life. A friend of mine was talking and asked me who I voted for mayor of Port St. Lucie, and they're both Democrats running. And I said, well, I voted for this guy because I heard him about 6 months ago. And he started asking me about the guy, and I hadn't really done my homework. And he says, well, what are you doing? You know, he's in front of me. What are you doing? You know, and I said, well, ask me about this one or this one or this one. Don't ask me about this one because I don't know about that one. And he was pointing out to me, again, basically what I'm saying here. I voted for a sign. I didn't vote for a symbol that has life that's pointing me to something else. Because in that direction, I need to confront, am I making meaning for myself? Am I taking the responsibility to stop and evaluate and understand what's going on around me and bring myself to a place where I can interpret what's going on around me, or am I allowing others to do it for me? Unitarian Universalists, we are called to hear all the stories. And all the stories are symbols, because stories point to lives, and they point to something alive. They point to suffering, they point to sorrow, they point to oppression, they point to celebration, they point to many things. at the heart of being a Unitarian Universalist. We hear stories, and we affirm stories, and we allow stories to have life. If we heard somebody in our congregation was struggling with an addiction, we would bring, I would hope, into movement a way of caring, not a way of rejecting. Because caring is a way to life. And caring needs to be a word that's a symbol of a way to life. Not when we hear something about somebody that's been hidden and that's been secret, and then when the secret's broken, because of the secret, we reject them. We need to stop and feel what's going on in the person's life. If part of us has to have a secret to it, I will guarantee you there is suffering with it. And our call is to be in touch with the suffering, not with the judgment and rejection. If we have the judgment and rejection, we will never move toward peace and forgiveness. The forgiveness idea. I have a spiritual director, my mother-in-law is my spiritual director, Betty Hare. She's about 82, 83. She's a director of special ed at Temple University at one time, of the department. She's Daughters of the King Episcopal. She always says to me after I do something, good and faithful servant, so you know I've got to love her. Unless I don't hear that every once in a while, then I question. And so I went to talk to her about this idea of forgiveness, because my idea about forgiveness was that if I have unforgiveness within me, it's harmful to me. It's a feeling state in me that hurts me. So I want to be able to let go of the unforgiveness, but be able to set the boundary so I'm not vulnerable to the injury again. That's my thinking. So I got to talking to her about it. She said, oh no, if they're still doing the behavior, there's no forgiveness. Is there something to not forgiving that sets a hard boundary, that makes the statement with some severity, what's happening is not okay? And periodically as human beings, do we need to do that? I don't have the answer. I'm in the middle of trying to understand what that means, because I don't want to hold that tension of unforgiveness within me. But here's somebody who is a generation older than me, whom I'm not as wise as 82, because I'm not 82, that I need to hear those words. Is my seeking this at ease within myself when there is this intrusiveness and hurtfulness going on out here selfish, narcissistic, an easy way out? I don't know. If I let go of that, would I be as motivated to confront this intrusiveness out here? I don't have that answer. But one way I'm beginning to search for that answer is, am I motivated to confront injustice, evil, oppression of others' stories? Am I in a process of confronting those? Have I organized my life to deal with those? Or am I doing something that's meeting my needs and kind of selfish along the way? And this is the way I'm beginning to wrestle with that. Can I have the passion to confront injustice from a peaceful position? I always remember the Buddhists protesting the war. That saves me. Because I think it can be done. I think it can be done. We need to be able to protect ourselves and clearly delineate our inner worlds from the external world. And we need to be able to hold the external world at bay until we understand what it is about. If I can't, I will not know peace within myself. And I need to be able to separate myself from the external world in a way. I know often there are times of meditation when you hear stories of people, and if you go into a place where somebody leads you in meditation and prayer, that they'll say, and now take your time to come back. Do I separate myself to even hear the words, now take your time to come back? If I don't leave, am I too thick in it to understand it and to see it? Do I need a discipline of separating myself from the world in order to be on a path of peace and respond to the world from a position of peace? I think so.